Radio Baltus Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, and I'm very happy you could join the program today. If you were with us last week, you will remember that the program led us into the early life of Milarepa, the great Tibetan yogi. A strong-willed character who had been wronged by his relatives, he allowed his mother to persuade him to learn black magic so he could take revenge, which he did, in the process killing over 30 people. Later he came to regret his actions and took refuge with a famous lama named Marpa the Translator. Marpa put him through immense hardships and difficulties to clear his negative karma, and we ended the program with Milarepa coming to the end of his rope, at which point Marpa relented and explained that the aim of all the hardships, including his own anger, had been to clear the negative karma and lay the ground for subsequent teachings and practices for Milarepa. We included the story in the program because it related to the slogan, "Don't lie in ambush." In the mind training teachings we've been following in the text Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by Namkar Pal. We've discussed this slogan quite extensively now, but before we go on, let's consider our motivation for being with the program today. It's best if the motivation is to gain enlightenment to benefit all other beings, which of course is the mind of bodhicitta. This motivation will bring us the greatest benefits because it is aimed at the welfare of such a vast array of beings, and it is completely opposite to the mind that lies in ambush. Anyway, if you cannot motivate with bodhicitta, at least think that this program will become a cause for your own enlightenment. Thank you. Now, continuing with the slogan, "Don't lie in ambush," here is one more commentary that might shed further light on it. It's from Judy Leaf on tricycle.org, who says, "This slogan is about the scheming mind, the mind that never forgets a slight or an insult. Instead, it keeps eating away at us, sometimes for years and even decades. This unforgiving attitude can cause us to cut ourselves off from long-term friends or relatives. It can become so rigid and fixed that even on our deathbed we refuse to let it go. Many people carry such grudges for life. Beyond simply carrying a grudge, we begin to plot our revenge. We wait patiently for just the right moment, a time when that person has let down their guard or when they are in a weakened position, and then we let them have it. That is what waiting in ambush is all about. We think, just wait, I'll get you back." You can see this pattern on the individual level and on a larger scale within organizations or between nations. First one side is insulted, then the tables are turned and the other side gets insulted back. First you're the underdog and you scheme about all the things you will do to those who disrespect you once you're in power. And once you are in power, you mistreat them just like they mistreated you. It is easy to get caught up in a cycle where we dwell on the many insults we've endured. We stew about them and how unfair and undeserved they are. We dwell on that and let it fester, and slowly we build our case for ambush. We lay out our plans and wait, ready to pounce. But we've let the insult take us over, and by doing so, we've become a slave to the actions of others. Those remembered insults we hold onto so tightly have taken over our mind. By working with this slogan, we can free ourselves from that unhealthy pattern. You can see this pattern on the individual level and on a larger scale within organizations or between nations, she says. Now, who does that remind us of, if not Donald Trump, whose stated credo, even before he became president of the United States, was centered on revenge? In an article on MotherJones.com, titled rather clumsily, "If You Want to Understand Trump, Understand This: Revenge is What He Cares About Most," David Korn writes, "Trump seems to live to settle grudges. For him, retaliation is a religion. But don't take my word for it, take his. In speeches and public talks Trump gave in the years before he ran for president, he held retribution as an essential element of a success. One example, in 2011, he addressed the National Achievers Congress in Sydney, Australia, to explain how he had achieved his success. He noted there were a couple of lessons not taught in business school that successful people must know. At the top of the list was this piece of advice: get even with people. If they screw you, screw them back 10 times as hard. I really believe it. Korn talks about a previous article he had written about Trump. In that article, he says, I cited multiple instances of Trump expressing this sentiment. In a 2007 speech, he shared his first rule of business. It's called get even. Get even. This isn't your typical business speech. Get even. What this is a real business speech. You know, in all fairness to Wharton, that's the school he attended, I love them, but they teach you some stuff that's a lot of BS. When you're in business, you get even with people that screw you, and you screw them 15 times harder. And the reason is not only because of the person that you're after, but other people watch what's happening. Other people see how you react. Which says that not only does he practice revenge, he also believes in intimidation. Even if people think that you act in a thoroughly despicable way, and even dislike you for it, they will still be very careful around you, like a mongoose is around a snake. And what does this say about the difference between the President of the United States and the head of a mafia family? What does it say about the values he projects to the millions of people who elected him to lead them? David Korn points out that Trump's speeches are not those of a well-balanced, gracious human being who can rationally assess costs and benefits. He notes that in an interview before Trump became president, the former House Speaker, Newt Gingrich, said that Trump often loses his cool in response to anything which attacks his own sense of integrity or his own sense of respectability, and he reacts very intensely, almost uncontrollably, to those kinds of situations. Gingrich thinks there's a big Trump and a little Trump, and David Korn comments that if that is so, too frequently little Trump is in control or out of control. This is a serious matter, says Korn, and he goes on to point out what happens when someone so powerful acts on his basic impulses. With President Little Trump in charge, norms and the rule of law are at risk, he says. During the transition, Trump noted in several tweets that he believed the U.S. intelligence community was out to get him. Since then, he has waged war on the FBI and the Justice Department and ignored the intelligence community's assessment that Vladimir Putin mounted a covert information warfare campaign to subvert the 2016 election to help elect Trump. Korn writes, now Trump is out to get them, whoever the them is, in his feverish paranoia. Korn mentions James Comey and Tim McCabe, former CEO and deputy of the FBI, who Trump fired, and goes on to liken Trump to mafia boss Michael Corleone in the Godfather movie franchise. He then points out that behind the lust for revenge is something nearly as nasty. He says, the flip side of Trump's revenge obsession is almost as bad. Trump has a profound yearning for acceptance, recognition, and compliments. How many times has Trump said that Putin is a good guy because he said something positive about Trump? Trump's highly personalized, you might say narcissistic, view of the world can undermine national security. As Trump has sought revenge against his foes in the FBI and the Justice Department, he has this week eased up on sanctions applied on Putin's regime for its meddling in the election. In short, for Trump, McCabe is a problem, Putin is just fine. The fundamental and inescapable reality is that a man driven by revenge is in charge of the federal government and its nuclear arsenal. He has already demonstrated that this passion of his is a threat to the traditions and institutions of the Republic. As long as he remains at the helm, the State of the Union will be unstable. So, in someone like this, we find one so insecure within himself that he is driven by an insatiable longing for admiration and acceptance, and also an obsession with revenging himself on anyone who insults him, whether the insult is real or merely perceived. I would think that these two would commonly go together in anybody that likes to wait in ambush. In an ordinary person, it is bad enough and can cause a lot of suffering, but with someone in power, the danger is greatly amplified. On www.billmoyers.com, Michael Winship, Emmy Award-winning senior writer of Moyers & Company, references Trump and Vladimir Putin in an article titled "Revenge is a Rotten Way to Run a Country." He writes, "Looking back at the last tumultuous year, to me, one of the saddest aspects of the Trump candidacy and presidency is that both in part were built from one of the basest of human impulses, revenge. We're taught that ideally, the desire to run for office should reflect a commitment to public service. And we know that the reality is far too often otherwise, running to slake a thirst for power and money that overpowers the greater good. Yet to seek elected office for revenge, to use it to get back at someone or inflict harm on them or anyone associated with them, seems in some ways even worse, shabby, petty, and immoral. Examine the roots of the Trump campaign and you see two men eager to use position to take revenge, to get even for insults, imagined or sometimes real, and to lash out at perceived conspiracies against them, Donald Trump himself and Vladimir Putin. Whether or not there was active knowing collusion, the two nonetheless joined forces to tap into decades of American fears and resentments not totally dissimilar from their own. In Trump's case, you don't have to go to Vienna to figure out that much of his egotism and vainglory, and those tweets, God help us, seem aimed at getting back for slights that can go back just hours and minutes, or sometimes even years. To be specific, remember the story of the 2000 White House Correspondents Association dinner, when President Obama jokingly skewered Trump, who sat at his table in grim-faced, aggrieved silence. Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker was in the Washington Hilton ballroom that night and wrote 4 years later, "One can't help but to suspect that on that night, Trump's own sense of public humiliation became so overwhelming that he decided, perhaps at first unconsciously, that he would somehow get his own back, perhaps even pursue the presidency after all, no matter how nihilistically or absurdly, and redeem himself." It didn't matter, of course, that Donald Trump had plagued Obama with a Bertha crusade to prove that Obama was not born in the USA and was therefore ineligible to be the United States president. Winship continues, "After the election, from each man, there was feigned magnanimity towards the other, but it didn't last long. Like an uncontrollable tick, Trump continues to obsess over Obama, blaming any and all problems on his predecessor. Nothing, as we all know too well by now, is ever Trump's fault." Meanwhile, the object of Putin's vengeance, Winship says, was Obama's Secretary of State and later presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. While she was Secretary of State, she took a hard line against Russia and, according to Michael Crowley and Julia Ioffe of Politico, was, according to Putin, a forceful proponent of regime change policies that the Russian leader considers a grave threat to his own survival. Clinton herself agreed, and in her book What Happened wrote, "Our relationship has been sour for a long time. Putin doesn't respect women and despises anyone who stands up to him, so I'm a double problem. After I criticized one of his policies, he told the press, 'It's better not to argue with women,' but went on to call me weak. Maybe weakness is not the worst quality for a woman," he joked. Hilarious. Winship goes on, "Of course, by most reports, Putin takes his revenge more bluntly against enemies at home and throughout much of the former Soviet bloc. Political opponents and journalists simply die or disappear. But when it comes to the internet, Russia's techniques have been infinitely more subtle and ingenious. In many cases, the nation's troll factories have been pitting sides against other sides with phony social media accounts that take every conceivable position on an issue." And he goes on to list the vast extent of Russia's interference in the American elections. Also in the vengeance mix, Winship names Julian Assange and his hatred for Clinton who, he thought, wanted him indicted for the 2010 release of 250,000 diplomatic cables. So Assange wrote in 2016, "She's a war hawk with bad judgment who gets an unseemly emotional rush out of killing people. She shouldn't be let near a gun shop, let alone an army. And she certainly should not become president of the United States." From such bitter nonsense, revenge unleashed, electors are swayed and empires fall, concludes Winship, and ends his article with this pointed paragraph. "Revenge is an ugly urge and a foul underlying basis for politics and government. It fogs the mind, disrupts equilibrium, crushes rational thought, and too powerfully motivates our worst instincts. Further, at a time when fundamentalists and nativists seek to rule the land, revenge is distinctly, you should excuse the word, unchristian, that it has so infected the body politic, bursting to the surface after years of festering along with its helpmates, bigotry, spite, and ignorance, is a sad commentary on the state of the nation. Revenge, another saying goes, or resentment or holding a grudge, is a poison you drink, hoping the other person will die. But in our current political nightmare, the poison affects us all. It envenoms and corrupts those who imbibe, and while doing so, murders society and democracy. This is an emergency. We must find an antidote, and fast. It is difficult to find a Buddhist commentary that better describes the horrors of revenge and waiting in ambush, especially on an international scale. But now let's put this slogan to rest and continue with the next on the list in mind training like the rays of the sun. Don't strike at the vital point, says the text. And Nam Kar Pal comments, "This is to reveal others' mistakes out of spite. You should never do this to human or inhuman beings because it can provoke such anxiety as to cause death." Now, we've already spoken in a previous program of how online vindictiveness and criticism has the potential of making people, especially teenagers, commit suicide. So Nam Kar Pal is not wrong in his commentary. Dr. Alex Berzin, in his commentary, translates the slogan as, "Don't put someone down about a sensitive point," and says, "We must never point out somebody's faults in a crowd to purposely embarrass them. There are many ways to teach people in an effective manner without embarrassing them in front of others." I was once in Bodh Gaya translating His Holiness's commentary on Shantideva's Engaging in Bodhisattva Behavior, and at that time, Sirkun Rinpoche had been in Nepal, so I hadn't seen him for a few months. When we met, he opened up the text and pointed to three words in the text and asked me if I knew the meaning. They were actually really difficult words, and I didn't have the correct understanding of the meaning, so he explained them to me. In fact, the three words he pointed to were referring to exactly the disturbing attitudes I was having difficulty with at the time. This indirect manner was a really effective way to make a point. Some of the commentaries also say that this point means we should use extra physical powers like black magic and so on if we have them. I guess this is not relevant for most of us. Now compare Sirkun Rinpoche's skillful technique with a boss who criticizes an employee for her mistakes in front of all the other employees. Dr. Emma M. Sapala is science director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University and co-director of the Yale College Emotional Intelligence Project at Yale University. And she has written an article titled "The Definitive Way to Respond to Others' Mistakes" on www.psychologytoday.com. It goes like this. Stanford University neurosurgeon Dr. James Doty tells the story of performing surgery on a little boy's brain tumor. In the middle of the procedure, the resident who was assisting him gets distracted and accidentally pierces a vein. With blood shedding everywhere, Doty is no longer able to see the delicate brain area he's working on. The boy's life is at stake. Doty is left with no other choice than to blindly reaching into the affected area in the hopes of locating and clamping the vein. Fortunately, he's successful. Most of us are not brain surgeons, but we certainly are all confronted with situations in which an employee makes a grave mistake, potentially ruining a critical project. The question is, how should we react when an employee or partner or child is not performing well or makes a mistake? Frustration is, of course, the natural response, and one we can all identify with, especially if the mistake hurts an important project or reflects badly upon us. The traditional approach is to reprimand the employee in some way. The hope is that some form of punishment will be beneficial. It will teach the employee a lesson. Expressing our frustration may also relieve us of the stress and anger caused by the mistake. Finally, it may help the rest of the team stay on their toes to avoid making future errors. Some managers, however, choose a different response when confronted by an underperforming employee: compassion and curiosity. Not that a part of them isn't frustrated or exasperated. Maybe they still worry about how their employee's mistakes will reflect back on them. But they're somehow able to suspend judgment and may even be able to use the moment to do a bit of coaching. What does research say is best? The more compassionate response will get you more powerful results. First, compassion and curiosity increase employee loyalty and trust. Research has shown that feelings of warmth and positive relationships at work have a greater say over employee loyalty than the size of their paycheck. In particular, a study by Jonathan Haidt of New York University shows that the more employees look up to their leaders and are moved by their compassion or kindness, a state he terms elevation, the more loyal they become to him or her. So if you are more compassionate to your employee, not only will he or she be more loyal to you, but anyone else who has witnessed your behavior may also experience elevation and feel more devoted to you. Conversely, responding with anger or frustration erodes loyalty. As Adam Grant, professor at the Wharton Business School and best-selling author of Give and Take, points out, that because of the law of reciprocity, if you embarrass or blame an employee too harshly, your reaction may end up coming around to haunt you. Next time you need to rely on that employee, you may have lost some of the loyalty that was there before, he told me. We're especially sensitive to signs of trustworthiness in our leaders, and compassion increases our willingness to trust. Simply put, our brains respond more positively to bosses who have shown us empathy, as neuroimaging research confirms. Employee trust, in turn, improves performance. Dottie, who is also director of Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, recalls his first experience in the OR room. He was so nervous that he perspired profusely. Soon enough, a drop of sweat fell into the operation site and contaminated it. The operation was a simple one, and the patient's life was in no way at stake. As for the operation site, it could have easily been irrigated. However, the operating surgeon, one of the biggest names in surgery at the time, was so angry that he kicked Dottie out of the OR room. Dottie recalls to returning home and crying tears of devastation. Tellingly, Dottie explains in an interview how, if the surgeon had acted differently, he would have gained Dottie's undying loyalty. If the surgeon, instead of raging, had said something like, "Listen, young man, watch what just happened. You contaminated the field. I know you're nervous, but you can't be nervous if you want to be a surgeon. Why don't you just go outside and take a few minutes to collect yourself? Readjust your cap in such a way that the sweat doesn't pour down your face. Then come back and I'll show you something." Well then, he would have been my hero forever. Not only does an angry response erode loyalty and trust, it also inhibits creativity by jacking up the employee's stress levels. As Dottie explains, creating an environment where there is fear, anxiety, and lack of trust makes people shut down. If people have fear and anxiety, we know from neuroscience that their threat response is engaged, their cognitive control is impacted. As a consequence, their productivity and creativity diminish. For instance, brain imaging studies show that when we feel safe, our brain's stress response is lower. Grant also agrees that when you respond in a frustrated, furious manner, the employee becomes less likely to take risks in the future because he or she worries about the negative consequences of making mistakes. In other words, you kill the culture of experimentation that is critical to learning and innovation. Grant refers to research by Fiona Lee at the University of Michigan that shows that promoting a culture of safety, rather than fear of negative consequences, helps encourage the spirit of experimentation so critical for creativity. Sapala continues, "There is, of course, a reason we feel anger. Research shows that feelings of anger can have beneficial results. For example, they can give us energy to stand up against injustice. Moreover, they make us appear more powerful. However, when as a leader you express negative emotions like anger, your employees actually view you as less effective. Conversely, being likable and projecting warmth, not toughness, gives leaders a distinct advantage, as Amy Cuddy of Harvard Business School has shown. So, how can you respond with more compassion the next time an employee makes a serious mistake?" Now, Dr. Sapale is addressing her question to managers and bosses, but it equally applies to any of our interactions with others. When our kids make mistakes, do we yell at them in front of everyone else? When our partner doesn't do something just the way we want, do we point out their error in the most cutting tone we can muster? Pema Chodron makes the point that when we act in this way, we're actually dumping our suffering onto those we're criticizing. In Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living, she follows her teacher Chogyong Trungpa in translating the slogan as, "Don't bring things to a painful point," and writes, "These are nuances of the human tragedy, nuances of the tragicomic situation in which we find ourselves. Don't bring things to a painful point is again saying, don't humiliate people. We do all of these things because we feel pain, because we feel hurt and separate. Instead of first making friends with what we're feeling, and then second, trying to communicate, we have all these ways of keeping the us and them story solid and strong. That's what causes all the pain on this earth, including the fact that the ecosystem is turned upside down. All of that comes from people not making friends with themselves and never being willing to communicate with the one they consider to be the troublemaker. That's how we stay caught in this battleground, this war zone. We will continue with this next time, but now our time is up. Thank you for tuning in today. Please dedicate the positive potential of the program, as we usually do, to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. Thank you, and goodbye. No!
is a member of Karma.